Centralizētais eksāmens angļu valodā – augstākais mācību satura apguves līmenis.
Hello, this is the listening part of your exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice.
Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
In January 2017, it was Donald Trump's first press conference as president-elect when the term fake news broke out of media discussion and into the mainstream. So what can we do? So, Julie, I want to start with you.
So I think the number one thing our listeners can do is on social media not to share information unless they are sure it's real news. And particularly in crisis situations.
So what about you, Ross?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, for me, the best thing that anyone can do is just call fake news out when they see it. So if you see somebody on your Facebook sharing something that is clearly fake news and they don't know that it's fake news, correct them. Let them know. Comment, leave a factual link that kind of goes to Snopes, and provide them with information from a quality source. I think that when we call people out for sharing fake news, that allows us to ensure that the goal of fake news, which is to have negative and kind of skewed perceptions imposed on people, we have an ability to kind of curb that.
You know, we should all be reporters ourselves. I think one thing that, you know, previous generations have relied on reporters and journalists to be the ones that dig in and look at the details and make sure that what they're reporting is fully factual. But now with the age of social media, you know, anyone can share any sort of news. So I think we all at a grassroots level have to put our reporter hats on once in a while and think like a reporter and ask a lot of questions, especially if something seems off and doesn't seem right. I've been victim of that where I see, you know, a headline and it's like, oh my God, that's hilarious, or that seems awesome, or that's, you know, a point in my argument that I've been trying to make or something like that. And then I'll hit retweet or something like that. But often what I've been doing lately is trying to be a little bit more accountable to what I'm sharing on my network to make sure that I'm not propagating fake news, and is by just clicking on the link and reading through it.
I think it's just so easy these days to kind of see a headline that kind of resonates with somebody based off of even their own biases. And if something confirms your biases, of course, you're more likely to kind of share it because it's showing you that you were right all along and that idea that you had is correct. So people are more likely to share that content. But I think what we need to do is also recognize that when you click on that link, you get to see the source. You get to see what that URL is. And over time, you get more familiar with knowing, okay, if something's on CNN, if something's on CBC, if something's on one of these credible sources, you have a better chance of knowing, okay, this is legit content. There's a lot of stats that get thrown around these days that kind of come from nowhere. I know there's a stat that says that people are able to kind of connect with images 70 times faster than they can connect with a written word. I've tried to track down the source for this stat, and if any of the listeners know where it is, please let me know. But there is literally nothing but a circle of people sourcing each other without actually getting back to like an actual journal or a study that actually kind of highlighted it. So it's important to always look for who it was that originally kind of came up with a conclusion or came up with a stat.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
In January 2017, it was Donald Trump's first press conference as president-elect when the term fake news broke out of media discussion and into the mainstream. So what can we do? So, Julie, I want to start with you.
So I think the number one thing our listeners can do is on social media not to share information unless they are sure it's real news. And particularly in crisis situations.
So what about you, Ross?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, for me, the best thing that anyone can do is just call fake news out when they see it. So if you see somebody on your Facebook sharing something that is clearly fake news and they don't know that it's fake news, correct them. Let them know. Comment, leave a factual link that kind of goes to Snopes, and provide them with information from a quality source. I think that when we call people out for sharing fake news, that allows us to ensure that the goal of fake news, which is to have negative and kind of skewed perceptions imposed on people, we have an ability to kind of curb that.
You know, we should all be reporters ourselves. I think one thing that, you know, previous generations have relied on reporters and journalists to be the ones that dig in and look at the details and make sure that what they're reporting is fully factual. But now with the age of social media, you know, anyone can share any sort of news. So I think we all at a grassroots level have to put our reporter hats on once in a while and think like a reporter and ask a lot of questions, especially if something seems off and doesn't seem right. I've been victim of that where I see, you know, a headline and it's like, oh my God, that's hilarious. Or that seems awesome. Or that's, you know, a point in my argument that I've been trying to make or something like that. And then I'll hit retweet or something like that. But often what I've been doing lately is trying to be a little bit more accountable to what I'm sharing on my network to make sure that I'm not propagating fake news, and is by just clicking on the link and reading through it.
I think it's just so easy these days to kind of see a headline that kind of resonates with somebody based off of even their own biases. And if something confirms your biases, of course, you're more likely to kind of share it because it's showing you that you were right all along and that idea that you had is correct. So people are more likely to share that content. But I think what we need to do is also recognize that when you click on that link, you get to see the source. You get to see what that URL is. And over time, you get more familiar with knowing, okay, if something's on CNN, if something's on CBC, if something's on one of these credible sources, you have a better chance of knowing, okay, this is legit content. There's a lot of stats that get thrown around these days that kind of come from nowhere. I know there's a stat that says that people are able to kind of connect with images 70 times faster than they can connect with a written word. I've tried to track down the source for this stat, and if any of the listeners know where it is, please let me know. But there is literally nothing but a circle of people sourcing each other without actually getting back to like an actual journal or a study that actually kind of highlighted it. So it's important to always look for who it was that originally kind of came up with a conclusion or came up with a stat.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have 1 minute to read the task.
Yes, so my name's Robert Douglas Fairhurst, and I teach English at Magdalen College here in Oxford. What I'm doing at the moment, I suppose, goes back to what I was working on a few years ago. I wrote a critical biography of Dickens in 2011, which came out of a very simple idea, which is that the way that people experience their lives, full of clutter and confusion and loose ends, is very different to the way that they write about life, especially in biography, where everything is tidied up into a neat story with a beginning and a middle and an end. I'm also, at the moment, planning a new book about 19th century life writing in general, so not just biography, but also autobiography and memoirs and all the other ways in which the Victorians wrote about themselves and wrote about each other. So why am I interested in doing that? Well, I suppose it's because individual Victorians might be models, they might be templates, they might be individuals that we would want to model ourselves on, but not necessarily. It's also more generally because it's when you look at other people's lives, you start to think more carefully about your own life. So a good biography then can work a bit like one of those old-fashioned funfair mirrors. You look at it and the page becomes like a distorting mirror. It casts back reflections of yourself. That's why writing about the Victorians is a form of history, certainly. It's a way of trying to recapture the past. But it's also a way not just of looking at other people, it's also a way of looking at ourselves.
In terms of trying to recapture the past, a lot of modern authors are quite preoccupied with giving voice to the voiceless. So Toni Harrison does this with the miners, young children who went down the pits. Do you think that Dickens had a similar agenda, or was he trying to do something quite different?
It's a very interesting idea. He does give voice to the voiceless, but What he does very interestingly is he starts off at the beginnings of his novels tend to start off with a kind of panoramic view of the crowd, the anonymous throng, often in the city. So we don't know who anyone is. And then a bit like a movie director, he zooms in on individuals, or he zooms in on families or on social groups. And then he zooms not just onto that individual, but into them. We go inside their heads, we see how they understand the world, we look through their eyes, we listen to the world through their ears. And then at the end of the novel, we zoom out again. And what that does is, I suppose, it reminds us that Dickens could have chosen anyone else in that crowd to write about. It happens we were looking at the world from the perspective of those two characters, but it could have been that other person, or those other people. So it's not just, you know, the faceless poor that he's interested in, although he is interested in them. It's also the idea that lots of people are faceless to us unless we invest them with a sense of personality and dignity and trust.
Why should we still study him? Why should we still study Dickens?
Well, I said a bit earlier that he helps us to think about bits of the world that we would normally take for granted. And I think that's true. But he also might help us to think not just about the way that writers reimagine the world, but also people more obviously involved in changing it, like politicians or bankers or health professionals or, you know, other people who we invest our trust in. Similarly, he asks us to think about how the world is put together and the way that society understands itself and structures itself, and asks us too to think about whether that is the best way that society can be put together, whether in fact we might want to maybe reorganise it in certain ways. So not just aesthetically, but also socially and politically, he's a radical thinker. So again, for that reason, to go back to Dickens is to find a way of thinking forward to perhaps a slightly better future.
So Dickens is a social critic. He's worth reading for that, almost that reason alone.
Yes, but not just a critic of Victorian society. This is perhaps where people sometimes get him wrong. They assume that because he was a Victorian and was writing about the Victorian world, therefore his social and his political concerns were exhausted when the 19th century came to an end. And that's not true, because a good writer doesn't simply tell you what to think about a particular idea. They show you how to think about all kinds of ideas. And a writer like Dickens, even if the political and the social problems that he's writing about have disappeared, but however one thinks about the world, Dickens is the kind of writer who helps one to think about it with more nuance and subtlety and complexity.
Thank you very much.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
So my name's Robert Douglas Fairhurst, and I teach English at Magdalen College here in Oxford. What I'm doing at the moment, I suppose, goes back to what I was working on a few years ago. I wrote a critical biography of Dickens in 2011, which came out of a very simple idea, which is that the way that people experience their lives, full of, you know, clutter and confusion and loose ends, is very different to the way that they write about life, especially in biography, where everything is tidied up into a neat story with a beginning and a middle and an end. I'm also, at the moment, planning a new book about 19th century life writing in general. So not just biography, but also autobiography and memoirs and all the other ways in which the Victorians wrote about themselves and wrote about each other. So why am I interested in doing that? Well, I suppose it's because individual Victorians might be models, they might be templates, they might be individuals that we would want to model ourselves on, but not necessarily. It's also more generally because it's when you look at other people's lives, you start to think more carefully about your own life. So a good biography then can work a bit like one of those old-fashioned funfair mirrors. You look at it and the page becomes like a distorting mirror. It casts back reflections of yourself. That's why writing about the Victorians is a form of history, certainly. It's a way of trying to recapture the past, but it's also a way not just of looking at other people, it's also a way of looking at ourselves.
In terms of trying to recapture the past, a lot of modern authors are quite preoccupied with giving voice to the voiceless. So Toni Harrison does this with the miners, young children who went down the pits. Do you think that Dickens had a similar agenda, or was he trying to do something quite different?
It's a very interesting idea. He does give voice to the voiceless, but what he does very interestingly is he starts off at the beginnings of his novels tend to start off with a kind of panoramic view of the crowd, the anonymous throng, often in the city. So we don't know who anyone is. And then, a bit like a movie director, he zooms in on individuals, or he zooms in on families or on social groups. And then he zooms not just onto that individual, but into them. We go inside their heads. We see how they understand the world. We look through their eyes. We listen to the world through their ears. And then at the end of the novel, we zoom out again. And what that does is, I suppose, it reminds us that Dickens could have chosen anyone else in that crowd to write about. It happens we were looking at the world from the perspective of those two characters, but it could have been that other person, or that other person, or those other people. So it's not just, you know, the faceless poor that he's interested in, although he is interested in them. It's also the idea that lots of people are faceless to us unless we invest them with a sense of personality and dignity and trust.
Why should we still study him? Why should we still study Dickens?
Well, I said a bit earlier that he helps us to think about bits of the world that we would normally take for granted. And I think that's true. But he also might help us to think not just about the way that writers reimagine the world, but also people more obviously involved in changing it, like politicians or bankers or health professionals or, you know, other people who we invest our trust in. Similarly, he asks us to think about how the world is put together and the way that society understands itself and structures itself, and asks us too to think about whether that is the best way that society can be put together, whether in fact we might want to really reorganise it in certain ways. So not just aesthetically, but also socially and politically, he's a radical thinker. So again, for that reason, to go back to Dickens is to find a way of thinking forward to perhaps a slightly better future.
So Dickens as a social critic, he's worth reading for that, almost that reason alone.
Yes, but not just a critic of Victorian society. This is perhaps where people sometimes get him wrong. They assume that because he was a Victorian and was writing about the Victorian world, therefore his social and his political concerns were exhausted when the 19th century came to an end. And that's not true, because a good writer doesn't simply tell you what to think about a particular idea. They show you how to think about all kinds of ideas. And a writer like Dickens, even if the political and the social problems that he's writing about have disappeared, but however one thinks about the world, Dickens is the kind of writer who helps one to think about it with more nuance and subtlety and complexity.
Thank you very much.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have 1 minute to read the task.
On the 25th of September, Jessica Meir blasted into space and she is now in orbit 400 kilometres above us and travelling at about 27,000 kilometres an hour. So why is she up there?
On the space station, we are participating in a wide variety of experiments. So everything from how microgravity and the spaceflight environment affect the human body. There are some specific hot issues that we're looking at right now in terms of the health of astronauts' eyes. We're seeing some vision changes in astronauts that are coming back that we need to make sure we have a good understanding for when we start thinking about the future of space exploration. We have some evidence now that the arteries of astronauts are actually thickening in spaceflight. Even in a 6-month mission, we have about the equivalent of 20 to 30 years of aging here on the ground. So pretty significant increase, and we need to understand more about that mechanism as well. Those are just a few examples of those physiology studies. Of course, my interest really lies there, but we are doing things like combustion experiments. Even flames burn differently in space. As you can imagine, if we can eliminate any of these gravity-driven effects that we would have here on Earth constantly when we're doing any experiment, we might expose a whole new world of other factors that might otherwise be masked. Some of the other work in the combustion facility will help us hopefully improve fuel economy processes here on Earth, and also will look toward engines and fuel systems for future spacecraft. And when we're on the space station, we're also doing a lot of routine maintenance and repair. The space station's actually getting a little bit old now. It's about 20 years old. So as you can imagine, if a light bulb needs to be changed or we have to fix the toilet, we can't just call a plumber or an electrician. We have to do all of that ourselves. So it's part of the routine operations that we're doing up there. We go for spacewalks as well. Anytime we need to upgrade a system or if we need to conduct some kind of unanticipated repair that has to be done on the outside of the space station, we put the spacesuit on and have to go work out there for the day. So one of the things that I really like about the job as an astronaut is that it is very active and very diverse.
Absolutely. Thank you very much to Jessica Meir.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
On the 25th of September, Jessica Meir blasted into space and she is now in orbit 400 kilometres above us and travelling at about 27,000 kilometres an hour. So why is she up there?
On the space station, we are participating in a wide variety of experiments. So everything from how microgravity and the spaceflight environment affect the human body. There are some specific hot issues that we're looking at right now in terms of the health of astronauts' eyes. We're seeing some vision changes in astronauts that are coming back that we need to make sure we have a good understanding for when we start thinking about the future of space exploration. We have some evidence now that the arteries of astronauts are actually thickening in spaceflight. Even in a 6-month mission, we have about the equivalent of 20 to 30 years of aging here on the ground. So pretty significant increase, and we need to understand more about that mechanism as well. Those are just a few examples of those physiology studies. Of course, my interest really lies there, but we are doing things like combustion experiments. Even flames burn differently in space. As you can imagine, if we can eliminate any of these gravity-driven effects that we would have here on Earth constantly when we're doing any experiment, we might expose a whole new world of other factors that might otherwise be masked. Some of the other work in the combustion facility will help us hopefully improve fuel economy processes here on Earth, and also will look toward engines and fuel systems for future spacecraft. And when we're on the space station, we're also doing a lot of routine maintenance and repair. The space station's actually getting a little bit old now. It's about 20 years old. So as you can imagine, if a light bulb needs to be changed or we have to fix the toilet, we can't just call a plumber or an electrician. We have to do all of that ourselves. So it's part of the routine operations that we're doing up there. We go for spacewalks as well. Anytime we need to upgrade a system or if we need to conduct some kind of unanticipated repair that has to be done on the outside of the space station, we put the spacesuit on and have to go work out there for the day. So one of the things that I really like about the job as an astronaut is that it is very active and very diverse.
Absolutely. Thank you very much to Jessica Meir.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.